The Guardian.
Hey,
Swedish?
Brevit.
Ukrainian?
Tuharda kihala?
Punjabi?
Buon fine settimana.
And Italian. To many of us, these languages are as different and distinct as they come. Yet linguists say they can be traced back to a common tongue. It's rather similar to how we humans look different from dogs, sheep, and pandas, but if we go back far enough, you'll find a common ancestor. Enter the hypothetical common ancestor of all modern Indo-European languages, known as Proto-Indo-European, or PIE. This language is believed to have been spoken by people who lived from roughly 6,500 years ago to about 2,500 BC. Unlike biological inheritance, spoken language can't be found in our genes or in the fossil record. So exactly where and when PIE came into existence is still very much a matter of debate.
So there are these two hypotheses. They're different more or less in all respects. They're different on all three questions of where, when, and why the Indo-European language began and expanded.
But as we'll hear in this week's episode, modern science might be bringing us one step closer to an answer about PIE, opening up a window into our past.
Humans are fascinated with where we come from, and there's this idea that understanding where we come from will help us to kind of figure out where we're going, I suppose.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Before we delve into the recent scientific advances made in the story of Proto-Indo-European language, I first wanted to get a bit of historical context.
I am Andrea Calude, and I'm a senior lecturer in linguistics at the University of Waikato in Hamilton, New Zealand.
Great, that's lovely. Andrea, before we get going,
I spoke to Andrea via Skype and started by asking her exactly what we mean by PIE.
PIE stands for essentially the language that gave birth to the languages that are roughly spoken in a large part of Europe and some parts of Asia. So a whole lot of languages, about 450 different languages, stem from this one PIE.
And what sort of things are we talking about? I mean, when you talk about that bigger geographical spread, I mean, that feels like it encompasses language we think of as so very different from each other.
Yes, indeed. There's a great amount of variety there. We actually think of a whole lot of branches of this family. So there's a number of branches, the Celtic languages to the west, like Breton, Welsh, Cornish, Irish, Scottish, Gaelic. This is closer to you, to you guys. And then as we move through, we have Germanic languages like English, German, Danish, Swedish, Yiddish, and Slavic languages, Latvian, Lithuanian, Russian, Bosnian. And then we have the big Romance branch, which actually extends in the southern Europe as well as sort of to the east. So we have Romanian, which is my native tongue, and Italian, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. And then as we move towards Asia, we have Indo-Iranian languages like Hindi, Nepali, Gujarati, Punjabi, various varieties of Romani and Sanskrit. And then we have Iranian languages like Iranian Kurdish. And then there's a whole lot of other kind of languages that don't have big branches of their own, like Albanian, Armenian, and Greek. So we have a great deal of linguistic variety there. It's one of the major language families in the world.
So you get the picture. There's a lot of languages in this family, all of which supposedly came from a single ancestor, PIE. Something I wanted to know was how sure can we be that this linguistic common ancestor even existed? So talking about how we know that there was this Proto-Indo-European language, what kind of clues are there? Presumably you're looking at how languages evolve over time.
Yes, precisely. So the best clues we have are basically
the modern day languages that are spoken in those areas that we think form the daughters of what might have been PIE. So we look to vocabulary that is shared among the daughters of that language. And the important thing that we're looking to trace is lexical similarities, so words that are similar, but crucially, words with the same meaning that are similar. So we don't want any false friends. So, for example, in English, the word magazine sounds a lot like the Romanian magazin, but they don't mean the same thing. So magazine in English is very different to magazin in Romanian, because magazin in Romanian means shop, so very different meaning. Those things wouldn't be cognates. Even though they sound the same, they have different meanings.
So you're looking for words that sound the same and have similar meanings within these different languages that are thought to descend from Proto-Indo-European.
Right. And linguists know a lot about the nature of sound changes in different languages. So historical linguists who look at cognacy and perform what we call cognacy judgments are not duped by things that sound kind of similar but may not actually be all that similar, or things that don't maybe sound that similar but actually do share similar patterns. So, for example, a word like brother has cognates across a number of languages, like across the Iranian branch, you have bratar. In Slavic languages, you have something like bratarb. In Germanic, you have braer. And in Latin, frater. You can kind of see and you can almost hear the similarities there. But it's not always this obvious, I suppose. With an example like the word five in Tocharian would be punt. And that is cognate with an old Greek form, pente. And it's also cognate, and this may surprise some people, with the Latin cinque. So it's not as simple as just listening and thinking, oh yeah, that's close enough. You need to know a little bit more about how sound changes in different languages and what likely sound changes processes we have.
And so the million-dollar question, do we know what Proto-Indo-European might have sounded like?
So the short answer is no, not until we get that time machine. The long answer is possibly. So what we do is we look at these modern day daughter forms, and then we suggest essentially our best guess of what that original form which gave rise to all of these related forms might have been like. So for example, I think I talked about the word brother. So we think that Proto-Indo-European word for brother might have been something like brater. We don't know exactly, but we know it's possibly sounded a bit like that. The exercise of guessing that, so this is what linguists call the reconstructed form, the proto form, is not that dissimilar to kind of saying, here's a fossil of an animal, can you draw the animal now? You'll have some ideas, right? And you'll know that it's not going to be in certain ways, but you're not going to know everything about it.
As Andrea alludes to, the only way we could ever know what PIE sounded like and confirm it truly existed would be to build a time machine, which, as of the recording of this podcast, has not happened. So until it does, what Andrea and her fellow linguists have been attempting to do is recreate the family tree of these daughter languages, something scientists also do with genetic family trees, known as phylogenetic trees, when exploring the origins of living organisms.
Are these similar models to what you're using? Just talk me through those similarities. Do languages evolve like animals do?
They are similar. They're not exactly the same. And so these days, it never used to be the case, which is why historically those kinds of methods have got quite a bad reputation. And the word glottochronology, you know, had quite negative connotations in the community because those kinds of methods were quite crude. But these days, the statistical methods, the phylogenetic methods used in dating language families are adapted for language phenomena. So, for instance, one innovation that's been really great is that the current systems are able to recognize the fact that certain words within a given language are going to evolve faster than others. So you're basically allowing for varying rates of change. And that's really neat because we know languages do that. It's always tricky to know exactly where the methods are completely different in terms of similarities, because we know that the linguistic evolution process is not exactly carbon copy, kind of genetic evolution, right? So there are similarities, and those similarities allow us to borrow some of the methods and then adapt them for language phenomena, but there are differences as well.
And so can you in any way work out a timescale for how the language or how old Proto-Indo-European might be, or when it first cropped up, I suppose, based on looking at these links and similarities?
We hope to try and do that. We need other tools in order to posit timescales and splits. So in trying to figure out dating the language families, what we do is we look at other fields like archaeology and history, which can tell us certain events in time, or for example, the fall of the Roman Empire. We know kind of roughly when it happened, so when the Romance branch might have started to split. And it does get really complicated when you're dealing with lots and lots of languages, so sort of hundreds of languages. It's quite difficult to look across all of these languages and sort of say, okay, what's the best grouping, and how can we calibrate various events in time with where we are now to posit what the route might have, that distance between the route and today might have been like.
And as it turns out, this question of exactly when and where PIE came about is one that is still very much hotly contested. Something we'll hear more about after this short break.
The alternative hypothesis was actually that it was much earlier, maybe 3,000 years earlier, and it started with the expansion of farming.
We'll also explore the why. Why did PIE go on to give rise to one of the world's most prominent language families?
We shouldn't say there was something good about the Proto-Indo-European language linguistically that allowed it to spread. It was just that it was spoken by a bunch of people, a bunch of societies that had something that allowed them to spread.
We'll be right back.
In this week's Extra Books podcast, we're treating you to a reading by Bill Nighy of the Moomin short story The Invisible Child by Tove Jansson in association with Oxfam. Here's a little extract.
The bell came tinkling downstairs, one step at a time, with a small pause between each step. Moomin Troll had waited for it all morning. But the silver bell wasn't the exciting thing. That was the paws. Ninny's paws were coming down the steps. They were very small, with anxiously bunched toes. Nothing else of Ninny was visible. It was very odd. Moomin Troll drew back behind the porcelain stove and stared bewitchedly at the paws that passed him on their way to the veranda. Now she served herself some tea. The cup was raised in the air and sank back again. She ate some bread and butter and marmalade. Then the cup and saucer drifted away to the kitchen, were washed and put away in the closet. You see, Ninny was a very orderly little child.
To hear the full story, go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard about Proto-Indo-European, the hypothetical common ancestor to hundreds of the world's languages, from French to Hindi. We heard from Andrea Kalud about how linguists can look for clues in PIE's daughter languages to try and create a family tree of what it might have sounded like and how it evolved over time, much like geneticists can do with evolutionary family trees. But exactly when, where, and why PIE came to prominence is still something of a mystery. So I wanted to find out a little bit more.
Great. Everybody knows it.
This is Paul Hegarty.
I'm a researcher in linguistics, prehistory, and also archaeology and genetics at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Jena in Germany.
I spoke to Paul down the line and started by asking him what other clues we can use to explore PIE.
Paul, we've already heard how scientists can use similarities in existing languages to reveal clues about this theoretical Proto-Indo-European language. Where can clues from biology come in?
Well, above all, in the last few years, it's from ancient DNA. So these are human skeletons dug up from archaeological sites. And usually they take a very small sample from a particular part of the skull near the base called the petrous bone, because that's where the best chances are of getting surviving ancient DNA from the skeletons. And once you have that and you can compare it with DNA of other skeletons and modern people, then you can, a whole new field is opened up really in the last few years.
And so is this about looking at where people were at different points in time? Because we know that, you know, DNA doesn't tell us which language we speak. So it seems a little counterintuitive in a way to turn to DNA to tell us something about language.
Well, the DNA samples are taken from particular skeletons in particular archaeological sites. We can date them with radiocarbon dating. We know where they were. That's where we dug them up. And certainly there are, in regions where we know particular languages are spoken, or the dominant languages at particular times, certainly when we have written records, then we can be fairly confident we knew what language those people were speaking. And then we can look at their genes and compare them with modern speakers of other languages, or indeed with other populations in other areas where we don't know what the languages were at the time. It's not really, I mean, you can't do these simplistic matches of languages equal genes. We know that doesn't work, but there are other ways of doing it. We have a sort of linguistic record of the past from all of the Indo-European languages that we compare. We can take them back to Proto-Indo-European, and we know that really there must have been this big geographical expansion through the past, and you can see that in the languages. But you can also see human expansions in the archaeological record. You can also see human expansions now in the ancient DNA record. So what we're trying to work out is which of the expansions we see in the archaeology, in the material culture they left behind, which of the expansions we see in the genetics, and which of the expansions we know must have happened in the linguistics, how will they all fit together, which ones go with which?
Echoing Andrea's earlier point, this all has a touch of detective work about it, trying to bring together findings in archaeology, linguistics, and now ancient DNA, to create a clearer picture of what might have been going on around this time. But as you can imagine, this picture, albeit clearer from the input of three disciplines than one, can still be quite fragmented, meaning that exactly how and when this hypothetical language originated and spread is still very much up for debate.
Yes, so there are these two hypotheses. They're different more or less in all respects. They're different on all three questions of where, when, and why the Indo-European language began and expanded. So the first one sort of has been the dominant one for the last few decades, particularly among linguists. It's called the steppe hypothesis because it imagines that Proto-Indo-European was originally spoken on the steppe. So this is modern Ukraine, Russia. It's the steppe immediately north of the Black Sea and the Caucasus mountain range. And the idea there is that it was spoken maybe from around 6,500 years ago. That's when it first starts to spread geographically. And particularly the biggest phase of the expansion would be when the horse had been successfully domesticated and wheeled transport was around, the technology had developed, and that permits this huge expansion out of the steppe to all of the regions which speak Indo-European languages. The alternative hypothesis was actually that it was much earlier, maybe 3,000 years earlier, and it started with the expansion of farming out of the Northern Fertile Crescent. It's sometimes called the Anatolian hypothesis. It's actually clearer to consider it a farming hypothesis. The idea is that farming spreads out of the northern part of the Fertile Crescent, which is sort of eastern Turkey, northern Iran, south of the Caucasus, Armenia, and so on. And it spreads through Anatolia to get into Europe, and it also leaves one branch of the Indo-European language family spoken in Anatolia, in Turkey, which eventually would become Hittite, one of the first, the oldest written in the European languages we have, from about 3,500 years ago.
As Paul mentions, these two hypotheses differ in the time at which Proto-Indo-European originated. 6,500 years ago versus 9,500 years ago. They also differ in the geographical birthplace of Proto-Indo-European, the steppe, which is further north, and Anatolia. And of course, they differ in the why, the domestication of the horse and invention of the wheel versus the development of farming. It's this why I wanted to dig into.
Yeah, I think the best way to think of it is not in terms of a language being successful. It's the population and the society that's successful, and it's because of them that the language is successful. So the world doesn't speak, so many countries around the world don't speak English because English is a successful language. It's because of things like colonialism that spread English around the world that the language became a success. We shouldn't say there was something good about the Proto-Indo-European language linguistically that allowed it to spread. It was just that it was spoken by a bunch of people, a bunch of societies that had something that allowed them to spread at the expense of other populations and cultures. And so this is the answer to the why question. Why is Indo-European such a big dominant language family? Obviously, the people who originally spoke Proto-Indo-European had something. Now, whether that was farming or whether that was the horse and the wheel and the pastoral lifestyle, that's part of the debate. What was the real reason that made these people so expansive, successful?
What are the most recent studies using ancient DNA telling us then? Has there been a shift in this argument in recent years? Is it tying into one of the theories or the other?
It's actually developing very, very fast. The first really famous ancient DNA studies were only in 2009, 2010. But they were on Neanderthals, first of all, so 40,000 years ago or more. And the potential was already there to look at ancient DNA of modern humans, Homo sapiens, to look at their recent population history. And it looks particularly at migrations. That's how we can really try and track migrations in the past, because migrations are a big part of the two main theories on Indo-European origins. So the first real results, ancient DNA results relevant for Indo-European, came really in 2013 with the first ancient DNA from Europe, particularly Northern Europe. The first ones were only on mitochondrial DNA, which is a small part of our DNA. And then a couple of years later, like I said, it moved very, very fast. So that was 2013. 2015, the first big paper with much fuller coverage of the genome came out. That's now the norm already. And this was Hark et al. 2015. And that's the first big paper that's relevant directly to Indo-European. And even in their title, the title is Massive Migration from the Steppe was a source for Indo-European languages in Europe.
So we can tell which side they've put their, which side of the debate they favour.
You can, but they were actually very careful. They say massive migration from the steppe was a source for Indo-European languages in Europe. So this is really the big question. That's a sort of cleverly chosen title. They don't say it's the only source, and they also don't say that it's the source for Indo-European languages outside Europe. The question of the origin of Indo-European, this big Indo-European enigma, is not just about Europe. It's about India, hence the name Indo-European, and it's about Anatolia, it's about Persian, it's about lots of languages that are also spoken outside Europe. So they only studied Europe in that paper. That's where they had their samples from. So they say as much as they can say with what they had. So it's a source for Indo-European languages in Europe. That also doesn't exclude that some Indo-European languages in Europe came from a different source. That looks quite likely for Greek, for example, from the latest ancient DNA there. But really 2015 kicked off, this paper kicked off the use of ancient DNA for looking at Indo-European. However, since then, more and more papers have come out trying to fill in other parts of the picture. And in fact, it hasn't all been going the steppe hypothesis way. So, for example, they have samples from Mycenaean Greek archaeological context, and almost certainly speaking Mycenaean Greek at the time, clearly an Indo-European language, and they turn out not really to have as much of this steppe ancestry, really very little. So the big thing they first found in Central and Northern Europe was up to 75% replacement of the population, a huge wave of migration coming in from the steppe. That is not the case in Greece. They find maybe sort of signals like 10% could be explained by an incursion from the steppe. And then another recent, very recent paper, just a month or so ago, which was searching particularly for the Hittite. Now, Hittite is a famous Indo-European language. It was discovered on clay tablets in the middle of Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, clay tablets from around 3,500 years ago. And it took a while for them to be deciphered, but eventually it turned out that this was Indo-European, another branch until then unknown of Indo-European, the branch of Indo-European that's died out. So researchers, ancient DNA researchers, went for this and tried to get human skeletons from archaeological sites that are Hittite. And they got some, and a month or so ago published the results, and it turns out that they do not have any steppe ancestry.
So the battle over the origins of Proto-Indo-European rages on. And if the ancient DNA evidence is anything to go by, the answer might be a little less clear-cut than was once thought. After all, maybe there's a middle ground between the two theories.
What about this idea, though, that Proto-Indo-European could have spread in sort of a two-step process to the steppes, as it were?
Yeah, it's basically a hybrid of those two hypotheses to say that maybe Indo-European did start somewhere in the Northern Fertile Crescent, and it maybe didn't have to move far to get into Anatolia, but one of the movements was north onto the steppe. We certainly see that very clearly in the ancient DNA, that around 6,500 years ago, there is the populations of the steppe change quite significantly. They get more or less 50% of their ancestry comes from somewhere that looks like the origin was the Northern Fertile Crescent and the south of the Caucasus. So there is a big population movement onto the steppe, and then a couple of thousand years later, those steppe people expand significantly into Northern Europe. So there has been, since 1995, a book by two Soviet linguists who had put forward a different hypothesis, which was more or less this, the Near Eastern origin, but that the steppe was what they called a secondary homeland. And it was the homeland where the main branches of Indo-European that got to Europe came from. But that's not where the other branches of Indo-European came from, and they came from the Near East.
Meaning that maybe both the steppe and the farming camps are right and everyone's a winner. As Andrea alluded to in the first half of the show, though, without a time machine, we might not ever know what the true answer is as to the when, where, and why of Proto-Indo-Europeans' timeline.
The history of languages. Why do we want to understand where these languages came from?
But that's not going to stop researchers trying to find out. Andrea Kalud again.
Humans are fascinated with where we come from. And there is this idea that understanding where we come from will help us to kind of figure out where we're going, I suppose. There's this really neat studies that linguists have of children of migrants who relocate in a new land. And this is kind of a metaphor, so just bear with me for a sec. So basically, when children of migrants relocate to a new country, and they have to obviously learn a new language and adapt to the new system, those children actually do much better in their studies and in adapting to the new country, including the new language, if they are allowed and actually supported in maintaining their home language. So there's this kind of thing of like your identity shapes you as an individual and kind of allows you to be whole. And so I think humans in general as a species, we are really curious about our past, and so it is a burning question for us.
Special thanks this week to Andrea Kalud and Paul Hegarty. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.